Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome to the show, 908 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thanks for being here. Dr. David Blodgett is with me for a little bit different. He's on the phone today instead of here in person. Doc Blodgett, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Andy. Good to hear from you.
Appreciate you coming on today. I'm used to, you know, getting all the people don't realize this. It's a lot harder to do these things by phone for me as a host because I can't see the unverbalized clues, you know, body language or whatever. So we're going to do our best, though, and Dr. Blodgett will be great. He always is. So.
Yeah, I hope so. Thanks, Andy. That's good.
New magazine out, Health Magazine, is in, it's in doctor's offices, in people's mailboxes right now. Or if you want to go online digitally to swuhealth.gov, G-O-V, you can read it right now. And there's a couple of little things written in there, including one by Dr. Blodgett about respiratory diseases. Now, as I was reading that article, Dr. Blodgett, I was some of the facts in there are pretty interesting. In 1900, the average age of death was 47 years old. Today, it is 78 years old. That's a big, you know, for 125 years, that 31, we've done something right. What have we done right?
Yeah, well, it's probably the greatest increase we know of, you know, and at least in modern history. And yeah, so the point I was trying to make is, of those top 10 causes of death in 1900, seven of them were infectious diseases, individual infectious diseases, right? Mm-hmm. So diphtheria, tuberculosis, you know, those kinds of diseases. And now only flu cracks that top 10. So it was really coming to understand what infectious diseases are all about. That's made a difference. So in a lot of cultures, they have a big celebration if a baby makes it to 1 year old, right?
Yeah.
And it's because so many babies die before they're one. And really it's been immunizations and understanding infectious diseases that's made the difference in extended life, you know, so dramatically. So
one of the ones on the list back then, and I don't know where it's at now, but you mentioned gastrointestinal infections. What does that refer to?
So diarrhea, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, cholera probably, it's a runner for killing the most people in the history of the world. It used to be ubiquitous. So making water clean, getting water clean enough that doesn't make you sick just to drink it has been really a modern public health victory that's made a big difference in people's lives. And still, you go to places where they don't have good water systems and diarrhea, diarrheal diseases, like rotavirus and others, they kill a significant portion of young babies, 20, 25%.
So, wow, that's a big number.
Good that we don't have to deal with that now. So
tell us a little bit about influenza A that you mentioned. That's the only one that's still on the list of top 10 killers. Why is it so hard for us to get a handle on that one? Why didn't it go off the top 10 list?
I wish it could. It changes enough every year that it's a new disease, right? You can still get it, still have that. So the people that are most vulnerable to it are the most fragile in our society, like the elderly, infants. And so it changes just enough. We can still get it. Some diseases we've been able to vaccinate for and you never see it again, right? Like measles, right? You just, once you're vaccinated, you're protected against it. Because the influenza virus changes so quickly. I once read a description of it in a book. They called it the mutating swarm, you know? So when you vaccinate against it, you're less likely to get it, but you're also less likely to die from it. It's less severe disease. But the quest for the universal flu vaccine is still out there. People keep claiming that, we're researching it, we're going to get it, it's only a few years away, but it's just now this dynamic changing thing that most respiratory diseases are. So you hit cold and flu season and you see, you know, dozens of circulating strains of various viruses, COVID included, and we just don't have a way to create a vaccine that's 100% against it. So we get vaccinated every year for the flu because it remains the number one killer in America. Somewhere in between, depending on the year, 20 and 80,000 people die from flu every year.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, something like, say, tuberculosis or even, like you said, measles, it doesn't really change. And once we get the vaccination figured out, that's going to take care of it. Flu is, like you said, the mutating horde. It's like a Michael Crichton book, right? But it's one of those things that it just won't, you can't, it's like, the, you know, like trying to grab something like a greased pig, so to speak. It just keeps moving and changing, and you just can't get a handle on it, I guess, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So if you were to get the strain you get vaccinated against or that you get, you won't get that exact strain again, but by the time it comes around the next year, it's changed just enough that it can evade your body long enough to make you sick, you know, for that week or two that you have it. So we're trying to, you know, you get the word out about influenza immunizations to help people not have that 2 weeks of being sick if they're going to, you know, or for those that are vulnerable, that's, you know, a real risk for dying from it. So.
How does that compare to COVID-19? Is that the same kind of idea that COVID-19 keeps changing and therefore, I mean, a vaccine we might have taken 4 years ago probably isn't going to prevent the COVID-19 we have now, right?
Yeah. Well, it's very similar. But one thing that's been good about COVID is it seems like for most people, the initial exposure to the virus and the vaccine has proven pretty durable, right?
Yeah.
It hasn't in that older group, the above 65, but for most of us, it seems like there's enough of an immune memory there that we might get sick, have something kind of like a cold, but it's much, much, much less fatal than it was before. And so really, the recommendation currently you might have seen has shifted from everybody get vaccinated to those over 65.
Yeah. I noticed, by the way, COVID-19 is going around a little bit right now. My couple of people here at my workplace have had to deal with it. It's a different kind of one than the one before. This one is more of a kind of a sore throat thing and sore throat and the chills a little bit as compared to some of them in the past. In fact, I heard somebody call it razor throat, which sounds really, really awful to me.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how different characteristics get emphasized by people talking about it. It'll be the same as it's always been as far as, you know, it's COVID. And so some of that other stuff comes along with it. You lose your taste and smell and some of that. And, and can, you know, and some people go into more pneumonia kind of stuff. So we watch it. And it's kind of part of the landscape now, you know. And before COVID, there were 4 circulating strains of coronavirus. Now there's 5, right?
Yeah.
It's just how this evolves over time. And I think understanding the lay of the land is important. Cold and flu season is, it's for people that are fragile and at risk. It's a much more impactful time than for the rest of us. None of us want to get sick, and it's always no fun to have, you know, cold and flu season come around. But for some people, it can be scary, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So doing what we can is important as we talk about these things. So.
Little item came across the wire today, just changing topics a little bit. It is National Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Now, Dr. Blodgett, I think it's important for people. A lot of people are like, what is a prostate? And I guess it's a male-only thing, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a male-only thing.
Okay.
It secretes fluids into semen, right?
So, okay.
And, yeah, very, very uniquely male.
Now this my dad had prostate cancer, by the way. It is survivable. I guess most cancers are if you catch them early enough. But tell us a little bit about prostate cancer and how common it is in the United States.
probably one in eight or nine men will have prostate cancer at some point in their life. The older you get, the more likely you are, right? So right. By the time you're 90, if you biopsied 99-year-olds, you'd probably have 90-year-olds with prostate cancer. It becomes much more common. The question, the debate that is now is, well, when is testing appropriate, when is treating appropriate, right? Because a lot of prostate cancers, they just stay there and they don't go anywhere. And so watchful waiting is something that is a viable option in that world. And then there's screening, and who should you screen and how often you screen. It becomes very individual specific. And so a lot of the recommendations around prostate screening and treatment really focus on conversations between doctors and their patients and what's appropriate for that patient and what they need to do in their life, right? And so, but for the 10% or 15% or so of prostate cancers that metastasize and go beyond the prostate, that's a big deal. And,
yeah.
And over my career, I've seen those recommendations change a lot in different societies have different recommendations, and it gets really complicated, and I'm sure it's confusing for people. We've written about it in the magazine before, but for most, it's an issue of you know, going to your regular exams, talking through it with your doctor, you know, he recommends understanding what screening can and can't do for you as far as trying to prevent, you know, the worst outcomes from cancer. So.
Now, it used to be, you know, you had to literally have the, digital exam of the prostate. It can actually be detected any kind of prostate cancer through a blood test now. Is that right?
Right. So PSA and various forms of that now are much more in vogue. And, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, physical exam as far as for the doctors getting a sense for where that is and if they feel anything. And needle biopsies will still be a part of all that process.
Ooh, so sounds painful.
None of that's pleasant.
Yeah.
the initial screening for a lot is that blood test rather than other ways that we used to do it.
Now, I've heard that, I've heard a lot of guys say, yeah, I've got an enlarged prostate, which is, I'm sure, different than prostate cancer. Is enlarged prostate a big problem? What does that mean?
Yeah, so enlarged prostate is, because the prostate surrounds the urethra, which is, you know, the tube that goes from your bladder out,
mm-hmm.
Can cause a lot of problems with trying to empty your bladder and things like that. And so it's pretty common. 30%, 3% plus of men have a large prostate. So that's the classic getting up at night, having to go to the bathroom, all those kind of things that a lot of men as they age complain about. So it's not cancer, but it is inconvenient, right?
Yeah, for
and
sure.
Something to pay attention to. So there's medications that can help with that. Diet patterns have been found, you know, to really help with that. So there's some research you can do, and then again, it's one of those great conversations with your doctor. But very common, and probably a lot of people can have that. The question is, well, if you have a large prostate like that, benign prostatic hypertrophy is the medical term. Does that lead to cancer? And the answer is not necessarily, right? But it can be in that spectrum. You know? So it's something to be aware of and talk about with your doctor.
The other thing with that is, I mean, you always like to talk about the importance of getting enough sleep. Well, if you have an enlarged prostate and your body sends you signals every 2 hours that you need to pee, that's certainly going to interrupt you getting the right kind of sleep, right?
Yeah, it does. It really impacts whether you're up and down all night, how deep you can get into some of those phases of sleep, for sure. So it's not something to just ignore. It's something to take seriously and see if there's something to do about it.
It is, let's see, 9:23. So we got a few minutes before our next next break. I did want to ask you a couple of things in the news. Measles is, well, it's here in Utah. 14 cases in the state, 7 of them in southwestern Utah. But correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Blodgett, but all 14 are unvaccinated people?
Yes, that's correct for Utah. Actually, nationwide, we just topped 1,400.
Wow.
With 3 deaths. So with school starting, it'll be interesting. You know, we have, particularly in our end of the state, a really high percentage of kids that are exempt. Their parents have decided not to get them vaccinated. And so we'll continue to see cases. We just will. Measles is incredibly infectious. So when we were, I don't know if you remember these conversations, but when we were talking during COVID, there's a description we use in epidemiology called the R-naught, which means for every person that's infected, how many people can they infect?
Mm-hmm.
Or on average, you know, when you're looking at it as a population basis, the R-naught for COVID was 1.8 to 2, somewhere right in that range. The R naught for measles is somewhere in the range of 15 to 19.
Oh, wow. That's a whole classroom right there.
Yeah, well, you walk into a classroom, you cough, the whole classroom's exposed. So, you know, in the hallways, it's just so easy to spread measles. It's very, very difficult for traditional public health measures to have much of an impact. And really, the only solution to measles is a high vaccination rate, so you have that herd immunity we talked about. Otherwise, it's just too easy to spread. And so, as we look at this, and our vaccination rate drops below that 95% that you need for herd immunity, we're just going to see cases, and there isn't really a way to imagine or to. I imagine, but an effective way to stop that spread with a pretty high percentage of those unvaccinated in the population. So so that's part of the message we've been putting out is, look, if you're worried about measles, now's the time to get vaccinated. It really is. And the measles vaccine is as good as it gets, 93% with one dose, 99% effective with two doses. It's really incredibly effective. It's stable. You know, once you get it, you don't have to worry about it. It's the champion of all vaccines for that.
Take me through, if you will, what happens when measles is discovered. I think the one last week was Water Canyon out there in Hilldale and right. Colorado City. You're not going to close the school for measles, but you do as the public health department, do you have to put a warning out and say, look, if you haven't been vaccinated, you probably shouldn't be at school right now. Is that how it works, or?
That's exactly how it works. So once there's a case identified in school that probably was there and exposed others, we send a letter out. Or actually, the schools send a letter out. So we let the schools know, and then the schools send a letter out saying, look, if you're unvaccinated and you want to protect yourself, this is the time to go to stay out. It's a 21-day incubation period, you know.
Wow.
So most people will show symptoms within about 10 days, but some it's as long as 21 days. So it's a long time, you know, if you're going to try and avoid the disease by doing that. The other group that we always worry about, and part of the reason to send those letters out so people know, is those that are immunocompromised, right? So if we always say 99% effective, but there's that 1% or so that even if they're vaccinated, they can still get sick, right? And that's part of why, you know, high vaccination rates are important, is to stop the disease from spreading. So those that are most vulnerable, right, immunocompromised, don't get sick as well. But we've kind of lost that edge, if you will, right now. And so if those parents that have somebody that's immunocompromised, they can consider that, you know, and what they need to do, and maybe keep them home from school or something.
Now, talk about measles and what it does. Now, you mentioned immunocompromised can be deadly, but I actually had one of my relatives say, oh, I don't care if my kids get measles because it's a minor disease anyway. It's not going to really hurt anybody. Can it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it can. So here's, and these numbers are paralleled in the current outbreak. So about 1 in 1,000 death rates, right? Most likely in those that are really young. So, so that's been borne out with this current outbreak. We have 3 deaths, which is a little higher than the actual number we know about. Probably tells you there's more that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
But that's not really the alarming statistic. The alarming statistic that is that if you're under 5, the hospitalization rate is 20%, sometimes 25%, depending on which numbers you look at. And so that's, you know, hospitalization, that's a $25,000-$30,000 bill, where immunizations, you know, $50. So, you know, the healthcare system, as we know, is pretty well managed. And so a big influx of measles would be really challenging for them. So you're pretty sick, right? Conjunctivitis is what part of it. So your eyes are red and oozy, you know, pink eye. There's a lot of secondary pneumonias and difficulty breathing and stuff like that. Most kids that end up in the hospital end up from dehydration. They can't keep food down. You have a really high fever, kind of 103, 104 range. So they end up dehydrated and then end up in the hospital from that. So it's not an insignificant disease. It's a lot of healthy kids will do okay with it, but then we get into that, well, you know, you can say that, you know, my kids will be fine, but there's always that element of, yeah, but now you're transmitting to those kids that will do poorly.
Yeah, that won't be fine.
That's part of the equation that's really, really hard to account for.
Got a text. Somebody said, how quickly after you get the vaccine for measles are you then protected? Is it immediate, or is it take a week or two? Or
yeah, two weeks is generally the rule of thumb for a vaccine to kick in. We're actually saying, just for purposes of trying to be as helpful as we can in this, that if you have one dose, you know, within 3 days after being exposed, that should be good enough to do something. But, you know, the best is 2 doses to get you up that 99%, but the 1 dose at 95% is pretty darn effective. And so, you know, as far as all of those recommendations for school and stuff like that, we're saying at least 1 dose.
All right. We got to get a weather break in. Talking with Dr. Blodgett today on this first Wednesday of the month. Today's September 3rd. We'll take a quick break, back with more with Dr. Blodgett after this.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back. I'm Andy, 936 on KDXU. Dr. David Blodgett is on the program with me today. Dr. Blodgett, you doing all right over there? Everything good?
Yeah, we're hanging in there. Thank you.
Appreciate you being on the show. You mentioned this is National Healthy Aging Month. What does that mean?
Yeah, so we always want to have this focus on the idea that it might not seem like doing things that are healthy are important now, but what all the studies show and all the longitudinal studies, which are studies that follow people over time, is if developing healthy habits young leads to more health later, right? And so, and then as you age, that becomes more obvious to you, and adding those things to your lifestyle can do things to help, but generally speaking, the earlier you implement it, the better off it's going to be for your long-term health and happiness and wellness and all of that. So, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just saying, and what would these things be to implement? Are you talking about getting enough sleep, exercise, all the things that we know we should do?
All that stuff we keep talking about, right? There's that book I keep referencing where the title is, I hate it when the answer is exercise, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, get off the couch.
There's almost always a little more exercise. It does a lot of good for you. So.
Yeah, that's true. And, but the thing about exercise, too, I think that people, sometimes you hear exercise, you think, oh, doing jumping jacks and climbing ropes and lifting weights. And it doesn't have to be that. I mean, right? I mean, there are so many. I mean, just walking or, you know, if you find a sport that you love to play, whether it's ping pong or pickleball or whatever, that can be just as good.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Perhaps the best exercise ever invented is walking. You know, it's statistically, every time they do studies on levels of activity and what it helps you do, walking just really fits the bill for almost everybody. And so you go out, you know, the recommendation is 150 minutes a week. And, you know, or, you know, 30 minutes a day is kind of the general guideline. And when you think about that, it shouldn't be that hard to do. We have 168 hours and we're asking for, a week. And so we're asking for, you know, 2 hours of that a week. And it just makes such a tremendous difference. When they did an interesting study in elderly women, older women above the age of 75, and they put motion trackers on them and said, look, if we separate the women that do just a very basic level of some sort of activity, cleaning house, just moving enough that we can say that they got 150 minutes of just moving versus those that don't, you know, just sit on the couch, what can we show in their health outcomes over time? And it was dramatic, 30% lower heart attack rates, you know, 50% less hypertension, things like that. So it's really, really remarkable what even a little bit of exercise added into your routine can do.
I'm curious, I don't know if you even have the answer to this, but I'm curious, have there been studies done of people who live a mostly sedentary lifestyle, but they get their 150 minutes in, but it's maybe all at once or maybe two. For instance, I'm not a super active guy, but I do play pickleball and I try to play it at least twice a week, 80 minutes a time. So there, I got my 160 minutes in, right? But is that really not good enough if I'm not really doing much else the rest of the time? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually something the researchers have looked at. And so it's clear, I think, that being consistent is better, but it's also clear that if you are a weekend warrior and you go out and do it on the weekend, that's better than nothing, right?
Okay.
So, and it's almost as good as just being consistent about it. So, you know, if that's what it comes down to, then do it.
So the person that's active, you know, we'll give them a 10 out of 10 if you're doing 30 minutes a day and you're really active and stuff. And the person that doesn't do anything is a 0 out of 10. This, you know, weekend warrior type thing, like, as you called it, that might be a 7 out of a 10 or something like 7 or 8, where at least you're doing something. And
right. Well, and it gets even more confusing when we do things like have people say, well, you got to get your 10,000 steps a day, right?
Yeah.
And the data on that is actually pretty clear that it's not really 10,000 steps a day that gets into that kind of optimum level. It's probably more in the kind of 7,000 steps a day, 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And the impact is dramatic from 0 to 3,000, you know, the increase in the impact of that it's really a steep curve. And then it's also steep all the way up to 10,000. I mean, it's a gradual curve. But after 10,000, it's that J-shaped curve we talked about, right? You're actually doing more harm than good. But the optimum seems to be in that kind of 6 to 7,000 range, which correlates really well with, that kind of 30 minutes a day kind of thing, if you're walking consistently.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I don't think we do a good job of explaining is it's not necessarily that you have to do 30 minutes straight, but it can be broken up throughout the day, right?
Right.
So rather than circling the parking lot in Walmart, you know, 14 times to try and get a parking spot right by the door, you know, park at the back of the parking lot and walk in. That gives you 3-4 minutes, you know, off of what you have to do for the day.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, it's funny, you know, as you were talking about steps, I recently, my wife and I went on a cruise, and everybody talks about, oh, there's so much good food, and it's all you can eat, and you're going to gain weight. But I found that during this, at least this recent cruise, we were walking about 14 to 15,000 steps a day. And so even though maybe I did eat more and I had access to more food, I actually lost 3 pounds on this last cruise because I was walking so much more than I usually walk. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy. You know, so.
Yeah, no, you know, I actually hear that story quite a bit. People are like, I was prepared, you know, for the scales to be ugly to me. But actually, because there's some activity built into that, you're going to see in a new place every day. There's plenty to do on board, things like that. I hear that story quite frequently. It highlights walking is good exercise. It's good for you and does a lot.
By the way, just got a text, wanted to know, is Washington County having the shootout for flu shots this year? If so, when is it?
Yes, we are. So that, I'm not on my phone exactly, but I believe it's the 24th of September.
So it's coming up quick, okay.
Yep, so it's coming up quickly. We'd really love to have everybody come. We're just doing the morning portion. So we used to do it in the parking lot, and then in the mall, we're just doing the parking lot portion. Bring people out, come do that drive-through experience. We get you through in about 2 or 3 minutes, and it's kind of fun to interact with you and see. It really helps us prepare for our emergency preparedness activities, right?
We
were well trained to deal with COVID and other things because we'd had all that experience from doing the flu shootouts every year. And correct me if
I'm wrong, you don't even have to get out of your car, do you?
Nope, don't have to get out of your car. We take all the insurances, or it's, you know, $25 cash, which is really reasonable. And so come and help us. It's a good way to get your flu shot. It keeps us current on our emergency preparedness knowledge and the cohesion. And we're always improving, trying to make it a little better. And I think it's really kind of a fun activity. So come and see what it's all about.
The flu shootout, and I'll look it up on the to get the exact date and time on the website as we go to commercial break here. But we definitely want to get everybody and tell David Heaton that he can bring a nurse over and they can shoot me on the air here if they would like to do that as well.
So. We'll do it. That's kind of fun, and you do it every year. So
All right, let me take a quick break. Dr. Blodgett on today. It's 9:45. We'll be right back.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
9:50 on KDXU. I'm Andy. Thanks for tuning in. Dr. David Blodgett, public health official, is with us. By the way, I was noticing on the article you wrote for the magazine, it says MPH, which, of course, most of us think MPH is miles per hour, but it stands for something completely different for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that. It stands for Masters of Public Health. So
nice.
my wife complained. I went, you know, got my MD and then went back and got my MPH, and she said I was going the wrong way. So
more schooling to make less money. How do you feel about that, Dr. Blunt?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem.
Yeah. So, hey, there was an article that came across the wire last week about vaping. Now, they said we've already kind of established that vaping is bad for you, but it's not as bad as actually cigarette smoking or cigar smoking. But this article talks about that, never mind the tobacco and the other stuff, there's actually some metals, heavy metals, I guess, when you vape. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the reasons that smoking's so bad for you is there's like 700 compounds, and most of them never been explained or investigated for what they do. But part of that is there's also a heavy contamination with heavy metals in there, right? Cadmium and lead and things like that. And it turns out that the act of vaping and what's in the vape itself has heavy metals as well. And so it's becoming a source for heavy metal exposure that we hadn't anticipated, right? So there's reasons why I think the long-term impacts for e-cigarettes we just don't understand. It's new, right? We have 100 years of trying to study cigarette smoke. We have, what, less than 10 for vapes?
Yeah.
And so I just think it'll be a long-term impact. I don't want to be the guy, though, that says, well, you know, no matter what you do, it's bad. It's just, I think it all fits into that relativity kind of thing. And nicotine itself has impacts just as nicotine, right? It constricts blood vessels, increases blood pressure, it's addictive, all that kind of stuff. And so you know, moms that vape, they tend to have premature babies and all that kind of stuff. So it's certainly not a negative, a net zero kind of activity. It's not, you know, it's not zero risk for vape and a ton of risk for smoking. It's some risk for vape and even more for smoking. And
okay.
So I think studies like that help to establish why that would be.
Just have maybe 5 or 6 minutes, but I did want to talk about it. It's kind of a hot topic right now in southern Utah, and that's seniors and driving. My dad is 90, still drives. I think he's a very good driver, and he'll tell you, and I'll tell you, you know, maybe you don't have the reaction time, but you do have the advantage of experience on your side. Of course, we had this weekend an elderly lady, 89-year-old lady, that got on the freeway going the wrong direction, and sadly she hit a car that was holding four people. Two of those people died, as well as the lady that was driving in the wrong direction. And so it's right now kind of a hot topic. You go online to the different discussion groups, and everybody's like, well, you know, people that are older shouldn't be driving, or they should have stricter rules, or they should have stricter tests. And I don't know if Dr. Blodgett, it doesn't exactly fall in the area of public health, but do you have an opinion on this whole topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough area for the DMV folks and those that, you know, patrol this of when's the time when you have to shut that off, you know?
Yeah.
Families, I think, struggle with their parents. It's taking away freedoms. It's taking away, you know, the sense of independence they have.
Yeah, freedom.
It's really hard to get somebody to give up their driver's license, you know, and so give up driving. So, and I think, you know, if you're in that category, if you're wondering whether you're safe to drive, you need to really be honest with yourself and with others and say, you know, I'm just not safe here. I can't drive at night, or, you know, I need to really get some extra technology on my side or something. But I don't think we've done a good job as a society of defining when does that moment come, you know?
And, yeah.
Just the son that says, hey, you can't drive anymore, Dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then your dad hates you. So.
Well, really, you know, one of the things that makes it hard, kind of like when we were talking about flu, is everyone's a little different. And, you know, my dad at 90, I think he's a good driver, but someone else at 90, maybe not so much, you know. And that's what makes it so hard, is it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of rule.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's very difficult to know, to say a number, right? 85, you're done, you know, but there's a lot of 85-year-olds that do just fine.
Yeah.
Until they don't, right? And how do you know when that line is, when they've hit that, you know, that line where they're no longer safe? And so I don't know. I mean, I think you hear enough cases like this one. I think it starts to tend towards, well, we got to have something in place, but it's really a difficult level. And I think everybody, lawmakers included, know somebody that's done fine up until older, some that haven't. I wouldn't know how to put that line other than saying, I think families need to be willing to step up and say it's time. I had a friend who actually called the DMV and said, you know, my dad's coming in to renew his license. It'd really be a favor to me if you'd say no.
Oh, man.
And so they didn't, right? And
and
maybe there needs to be a mechanism like that where families can take some control. I don't know. But I think it's going to be a bigger debate as cases like this get high profile attention, and we have to say, you know, you can't just keep driving forever if you're going to be, you know, you're going to hurt other people, and trying to define that, I think, is going to be important.
Yeah, and there's so many factors too. Vision is part of it, but not the only part of it. Cognitive, you know, just being able to think things through, and just so many factors involved. And
yeah.
One of the good points.
I know a lot of people that are a lot younger than some of those older folks that are safe, and they shouldn't be driving either, right? So.
I did want to point out. I was talking about this yesterday, but I really want to point out that the majority of accidents, something like 70-something percent of accidents on the U.S. roads today, are still caused by people between the ages of 16 and 21. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously, headlines on what happened this weekend, everybody's talking about it. But remember, it's usually the 16, 17, 18-year-olds that are causing the wrecks.
It's exactly true. And alcohol's present in, like, 60% of the fatal crashes. You know, I mean, it's... There's a lot of issues that, you know, but that safety on the road entail that we need to be more cognizant of, and I guess get to some resolution. But you try and penalize people for drinking and driving, you know, and heavily, and it still happens, right? And with negative consequences. So
yeah, I did it.
If somebody can figure all that out, you know, self-driving cars, are they going to be better? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's hard to know.
Until they're not, and someone dies, and then and then we're blaming the machines instead of other people. And yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. So I guess you as a public health official, you have to look at the big picture, but it's not always that simple. I mean, there are so many individual little variances, and that's probably one of the frustrating parts of your job, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's what makes life interesting, but it also makes it really difficult because there are very few situations where there's only one answer, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I wish there were more of that, and that's why education and all of that's so important, is for people to be able to kind of navigate that for themselves and figure it out. But that's why they call medicine practice rather than, you know, rules, because everybody's different.
Yeah. He's Dr. David Blodgett from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. The website is swuhealth.gov, G-O-V, swuhealth.gov. And brand new health magazine is out. You can read some of what Dr. Blodgett writes, and there are other great people. There's an article in there, by the way, Dr. Blodgett, and I'm not sure, I don't know the guy that wrote it, but talked about surviving a motorcycle crash, which unfortunately I've had to do as well. I mean, fortunately I survived, but not fortunate I was in a motorcycle crash, but I highly recommend that magazine. It's a good read.
Yeah, injury continues, you know, to be one of the leading causes of death in this kind of 20-year-old range. So it's great. It is National Preparedness Month too, so everybody can check their food storage and their water, see how it's doing.
It's Dr. Blodgett. Thank you, Doc. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you. Thanks, Danny. Appreciate the chance.